Well, you know, this is the whole thing. Keep going, Jason.
A classic Lilith figure there in everything you've described, according to Jewish mysticism and basically everything you said. Anyways, that's all I had to say.
Well, back to the molecular humanity kind of thing. If quantum physics is really telling us what they're telling us, and I'm understanding what they're telling us, even atoms carry information, correct? You know, and so that the whole theory of entanglement is that if two objects who are connected get disconnected, they carry the memory or the information of the other object for the rest of its existence, or until the molecule or the atom is changed course. So this whole thing is applicable to all the objects in the Overlook, in that, you know, the Overlook retains this quantum physical memory, and that when Jack and his family go in, they become entangled to everything that the Overlook has experienced. So it's sort of like an exopsychology or the exopersonality of time and history. So maybe that whole flaky semen is sort of like, you know, this isn't the biological matter to conceive a physical child, but these are molecules from a creator. And just the mere, just being in contact with just the flakes, the dandruff of the creator will allow you to sort of ingest that sort of consciousness or that understanding.
I would completely agree with that, Bill, but I would also, I mean, I think that at least when I listen to you put it that way, I hear a tinge of sentimentalism, like it's somehow a good thing to inject, like it might potentially be a good thing.
And I don't think that it has to be a good or a bad thing, because things, once you open the door, you can enter it or you can exit. There's no point in quibbling about whether or not the door is letting people in or letting people out. The door is a door. So energy flows, and there's a model there. There is a structure there. So exactly. So once you understand the structure, or at least don't be repulsed by evil structures, because anything that lets evil in can let good out. I mean, it's surpassing or bypassing a rigid duality. You know, it's just like the death card in the tarot. I mean, it can just absolutely freak people out once it pops its head. But I mean, it's all on how you interpret it.
Well, let's step in for just a second to talk a bit about Halloran's summation of the hotel situation of those assholes need to be replaced. And if you think about the word replacing, it just means to replace or to like move from one place to another. So it's like he's saying that the assholes need to move, you know, that the shit needs to get flowing up there. And also another fun pun tidbit I was just thinking of like the dandruff connection of the itchy scalp to me reminds me of like the ghost, like a, you know, they talk about ghost wounds when people lose a limb, that it'll still itch even though it's not there. And sort of maybe another tip of the hat to the fallen Indians of, you know, the scalpers, the ghost scalp of Indian Wars past.
Hey, David, I wanted to ask you, John was mentioning earlier about you have a slogan or a tag that says in North Right Eye, John?
What?
Yeah, it's just in North Right Eye.
And I was wondering, David, how you applied your understanding of the magic square to a film like The Shining. Because the northeast is the direction to solve the magic square, correct?
Right. There's a lot of things in terms of the fact that it's built on a Indian burial ground, and then attaching that to Poltergeist, actually, and the fact that the spirit comes out of the television on Poltergeist at 2:37, you know. But basically, they have this reoccurring idea that we built this on death. And so how you basically this whole kind of power struggle thing. But the magic square thing is kind of tricky, and it's a big subject to get into. But the idea of the sun square is the beast, and Jack has reoccurringly like come across as like, you know, kind of like this idea of like this fucking beast. And so I don't know, It's a tricky one. I write about it, you know. I
figured it was a little bit bigger. I just wanted to know if there was any specific instances in the film with which you've drawn out and tied to something like that. But we got, you know, other ways of getting into that later.
I think the big thing is just mainly what we were talking about before, about the pleasure principle and the death instinct being one and the same, and how, I mean, it seems like Freud and Jung's ideas are very much embedded in all of Kubrick's films. And he gives like abundant clues to that being his inspiration. As I expressed it openly about Full Metal Jacket, you know, that you're talking about Carl Jung and his shadow, and the fact that you never see these darkened figures who are supposed to be the enemy. And the truth is we have seen the enemy, and it is us, and they're really fighting themselves, and it's their own breakdown. It's expressing what that means. But and then, you know, like I said, the red book is sitting there on Ullman's desk at the beginning of The Shining, which is something that you can't, it's hard to see it on the small screen. Like, you go and see this in the theater, which I've done a couple times with Kubrick films. Whenever they show, like, Midnight Movie, I fucking go, because you'll catch these things. You're like, dude, I've seen this that many times, and I never noticed that that's the red book. So, like, I mean, that was Carl Jung's magnum opus, you know, and if you ever get a chance to look at it, I'd highly recommend it. But you can see that these ideas are embedded in the text. But yeah, the Babylonian sun squares, Babylonian planetary squares, I definitely feel like it's worth studying and seeing how they apply, because they do. So.
Well, you know, take this idea of if the north right eye is the northeast, and I think it's Kyle Hunt pointed out that when you say Providence is in Rhode Island, so you have in our eye. So Providence, Rhode Island, there's this idea of, you know, focusing geographically on the Northeast, and something that I've written about a number of times, this idea that I feel like 9/11 is this Isis and Osiris orgasmic experience, that you can actually see the island of Manhattan as Osiris's severed phallus. If you look, the smoke cloud is coming out of the tip. It's covering Statue of Liberty, which is modeled after Isis, and I've also shown two major Horus connections, where the Egyptian constellation Horus is directly at the zenith over New York City as the towers fall, and that the if you go the tip of Manhattan and then Statue of Liberty, and the next thing is what's called the St. George Ferry Terminal, and I've shown how St. George and Horus are essentially the same thing. So you do have this sort of mythology playing out in the in this event. Now, what a lot of 9/11 researchers point out, this, you know, idea that it wasn't just, you know, the Twin Towers that fell, but World Trade Center 7, and everyone harps on WTC 7, as if that was the third, you know, everyone says three buildings fell that day. Well, actually, four buildings fell. There was a small building in between the two towers. There was WTC 3. It was a small hotel. Jason will get a kick out of this. It was 22 stories tall. So we have a Tyrone narrative, of course, at play. This is actually connecting the Twin Towers. So you have two Twin Towers, and they're connected by a 22-story or Tyrone narrative. But there's this idea that if you look, then there's four buildings that collapsed that day. You have the numbers 1, 2, 3, and 7. Now, play that out as in Stephen King's novel, it's room 217, and in the movie it becomes room 237. Well, if the numbers that are at play there are 1, 2, 3, and 7. You can make either room 217 or room 237 in your north right eye.
I never heard of this Colossus of Rhodes business. It doesn't even feel familiar. That's epic. The Rhodes?
One of the seven wonders of the world. But I just looked it up just because of the Rhodes, because of Rhode Island and the images of, you know, a colossus standing on top of two towers.
Exactly, and Liberty was called the modern...
But that's just a sink that just happened, so there you go.
Yeah, and also his head looks severed in the bottom picture there. There's like one picture on top where he's standing on the towers, and then on another picture he's not, and there's a severed head there. So it's kind of like the ISIS thing, you know?
Yeah, Statue of Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to go back to 237 and how it applies to America, and to bring back the Magic Square real quick, it seems to me that, you know, McKenna talks about the alchemical empire that never was, and I'm going to get the specifics all fucked up, but there was a move in the 1600s, I think in Germany, to establish an alchemical empire. And before they could wed the two people involved and establish this thing, I think it's where we get the whole the word Bohemia. So the Bohemians,
yeah,
this is their whole vision.
Gates' book, the Rosicrucian Enlightenment.
So they were attempting to do that, but they were attempting to graft an alchemical empire on an existing empire. But you can't do that. And so a war, I think it was the 30 Years' War that led it, that was the result of this. And the dream was dissolved. So although the planning and the architecture and was ruined, the dream was still alive. And I think that this is why you have Amsterdam creating, or New Amsterdam was the original name for Manhattan, right? The graveyard of America, or the Native American land, was the tabula rasa for this dream. And these people moved in and they set up their magic square, and the independence of this project began in 1776. So the 237-year project ends in 2013, which is the culmination of the original dream, which started with the Mayans and has sort of infected itself as reflections into certain very bright minds, one of them being Terence McKenna, who was a devotee of their god, the mushroom.
Wait. Bill, Paul, I'm sorry. I don't mean to cut you off. So if you look at the map I just sent you, so you have that it's buildings 1, 2, and 3. So the Twin Towers are WTC 1, WTC 2, and with the 3 in the middle. So you have your 237 at the bottom. What's being constructed there right now, the quote-unquote Freedom Tower or One World Tower, whatever they want to call it, is, of course, 176 feet tall. So your 176 plus 237 is 2013. It's literally being built on room 237 is 1776 feet tall.
Weird.
See, I told you. But really, if these alchemists, if they had enough working knowledge to say, hey, how do you construct a society that reaches the stars? Well, you got to start from scratch. And so the new world was that scratch. And, you know, they created these states so that each little individual state could build up into a power structure. But they all culminate in the Northeast, which is New York City, which is Oz. And after 237 years, we should make contact with the stars. It seems to me that really we've already gotten there. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure Mark can jump in.
Wait, John, if you may, John Fell Ryan just wrote, two 13s in The Shining, and I would like you to expand that, because 13 is in the alphabet is the letter M, and David and I have both focused on the MM connection. So two 13s would be MM. John, what? So what are the two?
In the scene, the like Playgirl magazine scene, there's a woman wearing a red sports jersey that crosses paths with Ullman, and has like, you just see it just for a second, like has a big 13 on her back. And then later in the games room, right next to the left of the dartboard, blackboard is what seems to be like a 13, just written. I don't know. I'm not sure what it's for. Probably some 13th annual ski fun thing or something like that.
And of course, the death card is the 13th card.
Right. So The Doors 13, which is the last album that The Doors did while Jim Morrison was alive, is what I overlaid with the Shining. And so that's like very strange.
But it's also a way for Kubrick to sneak in like sort of like cliched horror movie stuff, you know, having 13s and, you know, in a movie where he supposedly avoids all cliches, you know, he has every single one of them in there, but it's just sublimated and made strange.
Well, like
have you seen The Witch in the games room?
No.
To the right of the door that Danny is next to when he's throwing darts, there's what seems to be like a woman hunched over in a red dress, like maybe giving fellatio to some thin male figure. Like, it's one of those blurry things that you can't quite make out in that room.
Really? There's the Monarch poster right next to the twins when they show up to the left. Ski, yeah. Monarch. Which I thought was kind of interesting, because you have the monarchy and you had that woman who had that whole claim of the CIA having the Monarch program, which may or may not be true. But yeah.
Yeah, but it might be a red herring to throw you off from the real mystery of what the heck is going on in between the twin's head. Like, that poster is completely a complete mystery to me.
Yeah, totally.
I'm gonna disagree with that, guys. If we're talking about the ski poster with the man who appears to have either the sun right behind his head, right? So there's a triangular shape with a light at the top. So you have your pyramid with a light at the top. And then underneath it says Ski Monarch. Well, what's interesting about this image is the font on the term Ski Monarch. Okay, so I'm just going to give you a bit of background for this. Rob Adger points out, in his analysis of Full Metal Jacket, I'm not even sure if this is online anymore. He's taking a lot of it down because he wants to sell the stuff. He's making DVDs to sell. But in his early analysis, he actually went out. This guy is like a seriously hard worker when it comes, again, complete dipshit, but a hard worker. Anyway, he goes out and he actually has the Vietnamese phrases on water towers translated into English so that he can know what they say. And there's a water tower that has this Vietnamese phrase on it. And what it reads in English is, to continuously serve your majesty, Satan. Okay? So to continuously serve your majesty, Satan. Now, if we go back to the poster here, what we don't really have... Now, Adger, by the way, just so you know, Adger's philosophy on that water tower translation is that he's saying that war is hell, so that, you know, these guys are in there and you know, they're experiencing hell. Well, my take on it is that it's Stanley Kubrick's signature, basically. He's the people, you know, because we're not really seeing a real war, we're seeing a movie, and the person who is orchestrating it all, the individual whose complete vision is being served is Stanley Kubrick. And that's what I'm saying. He's signing the film, to continuously serve your majesty, Stan. Okay. Now let's go back to the poster in the games room. All right. What it says is, it says Ski Monarch, But what it really says is SK Monarch, okay? It's just the letter SK and then Monarch. The I is actually folded into the K because of the type of font that's used. So what it really says is Stanley Kubrick Monarch. So it's to me, it's another one of Kubrick's signatures. He's basically signing the work. He's saying, this is my signature. I am the monarch of this work. And one can tie, I personally, because of my own fascination with conspiracy theory, can't help but tie that particular poster into the concept of monarch mind control programming. In monarch programming, that's an interesting question, John. I'll address that. But in monarch programming, the use of mirrors and of the shining of a light in the face is a directly into one's face is supposedly, you know, because obviously there's a great deal of myth about this. But all of the people that write decisively about monarch programming talk about the use of mirrors, which is incredibly predominant in The Shining, and then also the use of the shining of a light into the face. So here you have SK and Monarch, and you have this person. And when you see the individual, the skier, it almost looks like the sun is like a headlamp on top of his head, like a doctor's headlamp. You know, it's
okay,
like...
Okay, this guy is standing in front of the movie projector. He's the dweller on the threshold, and he's standing in front of a movie projector, and he's the one holding up the shadows, and he is the director, and you're absolutely right. Next to it, we have the Minotaur with the two alchemical figures on the inside of this little egg figure. And so here we have the Lover's card next to the Monarch. And so here we have, again, a depiction of the Lover's card where the shadowy wizard figure is pulling these two figures together. Sorry, I need to get all of that out. I hope you caught all of that.
No, you're dead on the money. That's exactly what I'm getting at, is that Kubrick is, to me, telling us, at the very least in regards to his films, that he is engaging in a Jay Wiedner is kind of the guy who sort of busted this idea open back in the mid-90s with his article called Alchemical Kubrick, in which he says that the movie 2001 is actually a very careful allegory of the alchemical process. So that fits in with what you're saying, Jason, but...
Actually, every movie is an allegory of the alchemical process.
Amen.
I would agree with
that. That's
what
Jay Wiedner
said. Well, you might say that reality is an allegory for the alchemical process.
Well, right. So Stanley Kubrick is Satan. So he's directing everything, and he's always putting in these alchemical things because he's a genius, a great guy, full of fun.
Sure. That's exactly right.
But this is the plot of Lolita, and again this Monarch poster mirrors a really good shot in Lolita, where you have Claire Quilty standing in front of the big spotlight next to Lolita, and really speaks to the whole theme of that movie because I think Kubrick said that he is meant to represent the Minotaur at the center of the labyrinth in that film.
If you don't mind, Jason, I want to go back to a comment that John typed in here a few seconds ago when he asks, is it King the Monarch? Not Stanley the Monarch, but King the Monarch. Well, and this is just an interesting point that since we're talking mainly about The Shining here, that there's a kind of a discovery that I've been hoarding for a long time. I haven't heard anybody else talk about this. And the main reason that I haven't published it is because I'm really still working on it. But it has to do with the credit sequence of The Shining. There are exactly 16 credit, cards. There's, Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, the title card of The Shining, the names of all the actors, the names of all the people in the opening credits. There's 16 of them from beginning to end. Now, it just so happens that there's 16 pieces on a chessboard, right? Where at least each person plays 16 pieces. There's 32 in total. But each player plays 16 pieces. Well, if you count in the normal way of English or Western reading, if you count from left to right on the chess pieces, say if you're sitting in front of the white chess pieces, so you can count the pawn, the first pawn as one, and then the rook at the king's side on the right would be the 16th one. Well, if you count them out this way, king becomes the 13th piece, okay? The king is the 13th piece, and Stephen King, the credit for Stephen King in the opening credits is the 16th or the 13th credit. So he's actually setting up the opening credits almost like chess pieces in a certain sense, because he matches up king with the 13th credit and therefore the 13th position in setting up a chessboard in the usual way, going from left to right top to bottom.
But again, the 13th card of the tarot is the death card, which features the killing of the king.
Well, actually, you know, that's an interesting point. And that's a little bit hazy because not everyone attributes the fool to zero, right? Some people attribute the fool to one. And so the death card would actually be 14. And that's very important when you're studying in terms of the Hebrew alphabet, because the death card is paired with the 14th letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So that's I'm just pointing that out as an important problem there. I'm not quite sure how that all works out. The 13th card would then be the hanged man, which is represented by the letter mem, or water,
which of course is turning the world upside down again.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. But so I'll throw this out there to you guys as Kubrick researchers. The credits, I believe that there's a code, I'm 100% certain of it, hidden in the credits of The Shining. So let me tell you one of the parts of the code that I've discovered. I believe that it has to do with the car, okay? Certain letters in the credit sequence actually touch Jack's yellow VW. They touch the car as they drive along the road. Now, the first four letters that are touched by the car are the letters R-I-C-H, basically spelling rich, right? And the last four letters are C-U-B-E, cube. So the first four and the last four letters are cube rich, or Kubrick, that the car touches, essentially. And I'm pointing this out because I'll throw it out there to you guys. I've been working on this for a long time, and I know that there's a lot more there hidden in those credits, but I haven't been able to break it any further than that.
No, that's awesome. That's incredible. And I just want to contribute to that in my sort of laying out of the five boroughs of New York City. As I originally got into this as looking at the idea that they were the five points of a pyramid, specifically because there's, if you look at the actual names, like, everyone knows Brooklyn, but it's actually called Kings County. Staten Island is actually called Richmond County. And what I sort of had an explanation of Kings County, Queens County was basically the King's Chamber, Queen's Chamber. But if we look north-facing, Queen is on top. Queens is north of Brooklyn or Kings County. So I actually apply this to the Hanged Man of the Tarot, is you have to flip it upside down, because we're in a pyramid, the King's Chamber is above the Queen's Chamber. Once I turned the map of New York upside down, it made more sense to me. And it was what ends up at the top, but Staten Island, which is Richmond County or Rich Mound. It's the apex of the pyramid, right? It's the golden-capped pyramid, the Rich Mound. So your idea of the rich cube, I feel like there's... It speaks to me definitely as a connection worth following through with, definitely.
You know, you were mentioning the snow is salt. Well, alchemical salt is analogous to ashlar, which is the prepared stone of masonry. So in masonry, when you have like the rectangular cuboid block, that is actually analogous to the salt in alchemy, which is kind of interesting there. In terms of all the snow and The Shining being salt, and everyone's having to fucking dry their skin out and deal with that.
Yeah, I really like the idea that the skiing monarch is the king on snow or cocaine, you know, which you put salt water up your nose to kind of flush it out. But I like this. Just sort of as another sort of play on all this is of course blow. And if you said that in the on the other side is this hunched over figure, which appears to maybe be performing oral sex. I would love if you guys would address, there is the scene where there's a man in a bear suit getting a blowjob from a man in a suit. So of course you have the blow again, but if you guys would address that, that's always been like, for whatever reason, nothing in The Shining ever scared me, but that something about that image actually frightens me. Every time I see that scene when she sees the man in the bear suit my heart just sort of skips a beat. And if you guys would address that at all, that scene.
Dude, you know, it's funny to say that. Because when I first saw the movie, that was the only scene that actually scared me. But I was like 12 at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just like, what is that? And I kept seeing that bear thing like everywhere I went. Like, just chilling out anywhere I went. It freaked me out.
I'll freak you guys out. Hold on. The thing about the bear suit is everyone says it's a man in a bear suit. One, it's not a man. And two, it's not a bear.
What is it?
I mean, it's Wendy. Look at the eyes. The eyes give it away. The bear has Wendy's exact eyes. Wendy's looking at her at the shadow of herself. It's a Jungian thing.
that would be interesting because she finds that image particularly frightening as well. So that would make sense.
I think of the Lost Boys because Wendy being like Wendy from Peter Pan.
Yes.
And when he says Wendy, darling, light of my life, like Wendy, darling is the name of fucking Wendy and Peter Pan. And then you have Pan, and then you have Pan's Labyrinth, and where does he die but in the fucking labyrinth? Like, and then also like Danny Boy, like the song Danny Boy is Danny Boy, the pipes are calling, and you have like pan pipes, and so there's like many levels to that. And also I don't know, I was just tripping out on like the Lost Boys being all dressed like different
pipes.
Animals, which are like, you know, I don't, yeah, totally, or toilet pipes.
Well, is that the first moment in The Shining where someone breaks the fourth wall, where characters stare directly into the camera?
No, I think Jack does it at some point.
Jack does it when he's looking at the mirror, actually, though.
But he's not looking through the camera. He's looking in the direction of the camera, but he's not looking through it, right? Because in my arrangement of the Transformer with 2001 above The Shining, in the arrangement, which is so bizarre, is that in the exact moment the fourth wall is broken in 2001... with you know, Blue Room Dave Bowman turning around and staring at the observer, looking at the observed, is the exact same moment as Wendy peering into the bedroom and the focus into those two characters breaking the fourth wall. It's like both scenes are absolutely intimately related, and when you align those two movies to play out from as that being a center point, I mean, all these other things fall into place. And to me, I was working on the early parts of arranging 2001 and The Shining and finding all these, you know, correlations. But then when I finally got to that moment, it was almost too much. I mean, I had to stand up and kind of look around because it just, it's one of those moments I'll never fucking forget. It still haunts me to this day, but that haunts me. I mean, it was like victory, you know, it's like I had finally solved a puzzle. But there's something about both of those scenes when the fourth wall is broken that penetrates into your consciousness. And so that's exactly why I think that most of us carry around that scene as being the most disturbing, because it's when the media actually looks at us. It actually engages us and brings us into the film.
Oh yeah, Bill, I missed the early part of it. What does it line up with in your 2001 arrangement?
Well, when Wendy is climbing the stairs and sees the vision of the bear suit and the man, it's at the same time that Bowman is staring into the blue room right before he becomes a star child. So when he's eating dinner and recognizes that he's not alone, he turns to look over his right shoulder, and the camera, it's just fucked up.
Okay. Can I jump in? In Clockwork Orange, the final scene, is this old man feeding this young man, Alex DeLarge, which perfectly mirrors this whole setup with the fellatio scene here. So again, here we have an older man and a guy in a bear suit who may or may not be Wendy Torrance herself. And so we have the concept that the old man is feeding the new man, and thus it's a transfer of power with the phallus being the transferred element between these two characters. and the bear, of course, being the bearer of the new consciousness, just as Danny is that new consciousness as the Star Child, being born by Wendy Thorne. And then and we see that with Danny on the bear at the beginning, and then later on, Halloran asks her if she's a Winnie, as in Winnie the Pooh. So does that all make sense?
Yes, mm-hmm. very much. I mean, I just want to clarify, the name Wendy was not a name, so the legend goes, the name Wendy was actually introduced by Peter Pan. The success of that story made it a household name that other people named their children Wendy, but the story goes that there was no name Wendy before that. I put a picture here, the Lost Boys from Peter Pan actually wear these animal suits, so you have that. There is also Jack the Bear.
I have some ideas on this, actually, that I think I can throw in.
If I just may, real quick, there's a... I have a really big personal synchronicity with this. And as a side note, there was a movie called Jack the Bear, which apparently has
Danny DeVito.
And if I'm looking at the movie poster right now, the highlighted letters are JB. J is red and B is blue. So here you have your twin pillars, the red and blue pillars. That's amazing. But there's a Duke Ellington song called Jack the Bear. And I just had this really weird personal synchronicity with it is... Years ago, I was writing this story where this character steps into this time-space sort of vortex. It was like this central node of all time and space. You know, basically, it's the infundibulum from Sirens of Titan. It's this, like, the central node. And what I wanted to do is I actually had this idea of what would it be like to step into this, and I had this idea to actually model it after the 2001 Stargate sequence. It never really happened, but that was my thought going into it. And I decided to just, like, really make it very, very abstract that the person's being overwhelmed by a little bit of everything all at once. And what I did is I was listening to the song Jack the Bear by Duke Ellington, and the CD started to skip in the player just as I was about to write this scene. So the scene starts off, the first line is Jack, 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 Jack the Bear is actually how I start this Stargate sequence. Just I have to throw that out there. It probably means nothing to anyone else, but it's a huge personal sink for me.
All right, can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, Tommy. You're back. It's such a vast topic, and we were the discussion of the bear maybe being Wendy, and the idea that of consumption, you know, being fed this whatever this is, this divine semen or whatever, relating to the idea of Wendy. Back when I was chatting a lot with John on Rob Adger's forum, which is now deleted, I was just about to go into the whole Wendy thing with John because I was we were riffing a lot on the whole kitchen sequence and stuff going on in the kitchen relating to Halloran and that whole scene. And I came on I can't remember exactly how I stumbled upon it, but I came upon a link to the restaurant Wendy's. Now, you guys all know that, and of course, Dave Thomas, the founder of Wendy's, gives you 42, right? Being the fourth letter in the 20th, or 420 as well, in the alphabet. The guy who is the founder of Wendy's restaurant. And of course, Wendy's uses that same color combination as McDonald's, the red and the gold. And I think this relates into this idea of consumption. The sun, basically. In the Italian translation of The Shining, when Wendy is reading through all the pages written by Jack, it doesn't say all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. If you translate the Italian phrase that they used in the movie directly into English, it reads, "The sun holds the morning in its mouth." Well, if you look at the flag of Colorado, you have this red letter C, and in the center of it is this golden ball, essentially. So I think that there's, this all ties into this concept of something being consumed, possibly the sun itself being consumed. Now, the sun being a metaphor for, first of all, semen in the sense of, you know, it's male, it's a male substance. And then also the idea of the sun itself, or the metaphor of the sun being the Son of God and in the consumption of Christ, right? Transubstantiation and the actual eating of human flesh and cannibalism. It's all tied in so tightly in the film The Shining. And I thought that was interesting in regards to the idea of absolutely. Wendy.
It's the priest king who in the Eucharist slays himself and then divides himself so that he can be reborn as a child, which is the theme of eating in the the regeneration room in 2001, and then again at the end of A Clockwork Orange, where the old man is now giving way to the new man, the illuminated man, who is Alex Lodge himself, who is pierced through the top of the pyramid.
So in a sense that the Saturnine principle is being spoon-fed to the subject.
Oh, the other thing that showed up in the other, there's like three different versions, right? There's like the French version or something where you got the translation of the sun. What is it? The morning. What is the saying? With the sun.
The sun holds morning in its mouth.
The other one was one certainty is better than two possibilities. So you have a version of Jack writing one certainty is better than two possibilities over and over and over again, which I thought was really interesting in terms of sync and basically the ending of duality, basically taking the two poles and recognizing how they fit into a single system. You know, that's huge.
That is
huge. And also that.
Mark, if you can look at these images I sent, there's the idea of having the sun, you know, the eating of the sun or holding the sun in the mouth. You have the green lion eating the sun is the alchemical image, and then you have this, it's the same symbol is the king eating his son, which is, of course, the Saturnian idea of eating your children. So if you, there's the image by Lambspring of the king eating his son, or look at the green lion actually eating the sun, like the that glowing ball of gas, sun. S-U-N.
Right. Yeah. Very, very cool. Very cool.
Hey, John, did you want to explain this night vision and the great party fish thing?
Yeah, sure. It relates to the our discussion of the pillars. Like, if you go ahead and look at that, the still of our great party man toasting Wendy in the eastern hallway. Now, don't like, never mind that the fish in the glass cube there, but look at the far right of the screen and look how that pillar ends up in the bottom right hand corner. Like, reality just falls apart there. And the molding just disappears into what seems to be like a poorly painted set. And so as the bear pig man scene sort of breaks the fourth wall here, this one breaks it even further in that, like, you actually have the film reality falling apart at the edges, literally.
Okay, what are you talking about here?
Wait, this
look,
is actually
the fish box thing.
Yeah, but look to the right of it. Look down in the bottom right hand corner of. Or at least in the center image that I have a detail of, you can see that pillar, the molding of the pillar seems to disappear. It seems to just disappear into the side of the pillar. There.
Right, as if they had only constructed the set to zoom out so far, and they zoomed out past that.
Yeah. I mean, referring back to Kubrick's technical mastery, what it really is that's the edge of the next pillar down, just made to seem like the corner of the pillar that we're looking at. So Kubrick's a master of putting something in the final frame of a moving image, and he does this again and again. Will put an object or something that you only see for a split second as the camera moves into it. And I'm sure that, like, whatever, how many hundreds of times they shot this little scene, Kubrick was waiting for everything to line up like that, where you'd have this illusion of, you know, reality having an M.C. Escher kind of effect of, you know, impossibility.
Well, that's like the chicken in that Marshall McLuhan writes about, where they took this film to these tribal people in Africa and they were going to teach them about water safety. So they show them this 5-minute film on how to appropriately collect water so that the water wasn't filled with disease or some shit. And they asked the tribal people, what did you see in the movie? The only thing that they could all agree on was that they saw a chicken. And the filmmakers were puzzled. They said, there's no chicken in the movie. And everyone that they screened it to said they saw a chicken. So they went back and they slowed down the film and looked at it frame by frame. And for less than like a second and a half, a chicken runs across the bottom corner of the film screen. What? Now, this is something that they couldn't see. They literally could not see it until they slowed down the film and looked at it frame by frame. But this is something that every single tribal person, it leapt out of them, out of the screen. It was the only thing that they really had any, like, absolute sense of, was that, oh, there's a chicken flying across the wall. So I've always connected.
Oh, you guys, I gotta. Yeah.
Gotta fly?
Go for it. Sorry.
I was just saying.
Oh, yeah, I gotta go take my rabbi to the doctor. I'll see you guys.
Okay, David.
Shalom, David. Take her easy.
You'll be king.
All right, peace.
So this is Kubrick's playing with the edges of our consciousness and playing with our dimensions of literacy. He's embedding within every inch of his films differing layers of perception. And it's all these different layerings of perception that agitate our unconscious and our conscious so much. So this seems to be a perfect example of that.
Is that a chicken head in the box? I mean, it could be.
What the hell is that? I was wondering. What is that? It looks like Pinocchio, or like a Pinocchio zombie or something.
Or like one of those Paleolithic fish that live 20,000 feet underneath the sea.
Yeah.
And never sees light or something like that.
Like a subterranean fish or something.
The image almost seems to be saying, it's a Leviathan at the rim of some world that starts to dissipate into chaos almost.
Have you seen Disney's Pinocchio recently?
No.
I actually have.
Man. The Leviathan sequence in that is something to be seen. Yeah. It's incredible. And I think Kubrick, having, you know, judging by the age of his daughters, had definitely seen every single Disney movie.
This whole scene is a reference to Alice in Wonderland, the Disney Alice in Wonderland, where when she goes into the rabbit hole, she says, "What a peculiar place to have a party," which is, again, the whole theme in Eyes Wide Shut, where Alice goes to Ziegler's party. And that's only in the Disney version, not in
Disney
book.
Alice also ends up in a hedge maze.
Yes. So, yeah, there are a lot of references to that movie in The Shining. Specifically the Disney version. Hmm. And then this whole great party guy is the Mad Hatter. And he sounds like Ed Wynn in the Disney Alice in Wonderland as the Mad Hatter.
And there is
the great party!
Yeah, that's totally the Mad Hatter.
There's the whole White Rabbit thing, too, with all the snow.
Notice.
I see this guy as Santa Claus, too. Like, he's got presents. He's got the tree.
Notice also that his head is broken open. So like I actually see you guys keep saying fish. I see it as an owl. So I have an Athena fixation. So I see this as an owl or a helmet, which of course Athena had the owl helmet. But his head is split open, like Athena splits open Zeus's head. If he's the Mad Hatter, we pointed out last week that the Mad Hatter. His little 10/6 is actually a symbol for, was it pounds, shillings, pence, which is abbreviated as LSD. So here, the man with the split open head, he probably is our Mad Hatter.
You know,
hey, did go ahead.
No, go ahead, Tommy.
Did you guys see that Curious Alice thing I posted on Facebook, by any chance?
No.
It basically, it relates the Mad Hatter to LSD, and at one point he's in a square, and it folds out into the shape of a cross, and I thought it was interesting, the whole cube thing, the whole puzzle box thing that's going on through his blogs.
Yeah, with all his sugar cubes, yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. The whole thing's weird.
Or the tea party of the interview, you know, like they have all these cups, but no one ever drinks them.
John, tea party. What was the Boston Tea Party? Is they dressed up like Indians?
Indians, oh no!
Yeah, Indian burial ground. Here we are. We're dressing it up as the Tea Party.
Yeah, that's also.
Do you see the Indians?
We're having a tea party on the Indian burial ground. Holy shit!
Hey, did you guys see that YouTuber, that guy keeps seeing bears and everything?
Yeah, weird.
Like it bears, like where, like in blank spaces. He's like, there's obviously a bear here. Like,
actually, you know what? I've looked at that guy's research and some of what he has. The thing of it is, the connection to bears, what he's really getting at here, this is, in the movie 2010, the second one, there's that well-known image of Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke posing as the so-called leaders of the United States in the case of Clarke, and then Kubrick is the so-called Russian leader. And this idea of the bear, it being the Russian bear, is important because, and you know, this guy whose research you're talking about, it may seem obscure, but let me try and explain what I think he's trying to get at here. Apparently, from my perspective, it has something to do with the research of psychic phenomenon. Okay, the bear motif in Kubrick's film, and relating to the films of Tarkovsky as well, particularly Stalker, having to do with the idea of psychic phenomena of some kind taking place, being represented by the bear. Russia is famous for its diligence in regards to taking the idea of psychic phenomenon seriously. And this takes place at a government level, okay?
Yeah.
So this fellow who sees bears everywhere, I think he's onto something because, in a recent article that I wrote called Medium Dick, and I'm just pointing out the article because if anybody wants to go and read it, I make a fairly good case, essentially, that Kubrick is essentially a communist filmmaker. He's a hyper-fascist filmmaker. I define communism as exactly the same thing as fascism, but it's mystical fascism, okay? In the sense that within the communist structure, you're not just a number. You're not just a cog in the wheel. You actually have a purpose invested by the concept of the commune, all right? So, and of course, you have this idea of the Russian study of psychic phenomena. So what I think this fellow who sees the bears everywhere is trying to get at is he actually believes, whether, and I'm not sure if he knows this or not, but I can't speculate. I tried to chat with him a little bit, but he's a bit cagey. He kind of keeps his cards close to his vest. But I think what we're really talking about here is a psychic war that is implied by Kubrick's films. And then in a larger way, and particularly in album artwork, you know, if you look at, for instance, the group that I got to wait until that typing's done. Okay, the group of design artists that did most of the Floyd albums, for instance, they come out of Sweden, and there's a strong connection to the whole influence of the Russian state in regards to psychic phenomenon, and I actually think that this psychic war bleeds over into imagery, and maybe purposefully, it is staged that way. And so I wouldn't be so quick to disregard this guy. His name is Sean Fella, or Sean Fellas, on YouTube. And he's a guy who has found what he calls the Schoen reports. He's found a group of sounds that appear randomly, well, not necessarily randomly, in the film, The Shining. John knows about this, and I agree with John. It doesn't sound like Schoen. It just sounds like somebody saying sha, sha, over and over again. There's this noise that appears in The Shining only in the first half of the film, apparently. But anyway, yeah. So my ultimate view of all this is that there's literally represented in The Shining, and the concept of the Russian bear is this idea of a psychic war of some kind going on. A psychic war taking... Go ahead.
Well, to connect psychic war, it's how we... what we define psychic ability to be, correct? I always go back to the old story of St. Augustine as being the only man in Europe who could read without moving his lips and saying the words. That there was this man that you just opened up a text, he looked at it in silence, and then you closed the text, and he could tell you everything that was in the book. And this just baffled people, because the way the technology of a book used to work would be you open it, you would speak it, you would learn what was in the book. So this man must have appeared to have been a psychic, because the way he used book technology was with a voice in the head. So there's always going to be a technology within humanity that for some of us seems as simple as reading a book, but to people on the other side would appear as a psychic ability. And I think this is perfectly illustrated in Kubrick's obsession with chess, because chess is a game which mimics war, but it's a psychic war. It's not a game of moves. It's a game of setting up people to do what you want them to do. It's about being able to get into your opponent's mind and to hear their thoughts and to know where they're going to go. So I imagine that if you were in a room full of very, very intelligent thinkers, or thinkers who thought they were very intelligent thinkers, if you could sit them down to have a game of chess, the greatest chess master would, in that, however long the game take, have a full, complete psychological profile of that person. They wouldn't need to have a conversation. They wouldn't need to know where they're from, because all of the pertinent and relevant information would have been transmitted to them through the act of playing a game of chess. And so that's what a Cold War is. What the whole Russian-American thing was, being that it was a Cold War, the king would be the atomic bomb, the one piece that is never taken off the board, the one piece that is never detonated. They both have a king, and so they just went through this sort of chess match with a war of information, a war of psychic information for those that were – who knew the game at a very, very amateur and limited kind of viewing.
You know, I would agree that the term psychic can be a bit murky. And your interpretation there, Bill, as usual, is astonishingly apt, I think. Because it's really about, you know, technology and or media. And I, just to go back to this whole idea of this emanating out of Russia as a concept in the Cold War, television and early film technology was pioneered as much by the Russians as it was by anybody else. And television was a Russian invention. So the idea of this incredibly powerful media event emanating out of Russia is a form of psychic war. And it all, you know, when you begin to look at this from the perspective of a conspiracy theorist, and I want to say, you know, that when I do this, when I, you know, put on the cloak of a conspiracy theorist, I do so for my own amusement. I'm not one of those people who's out there thinking that one thing is necessarily more or less good or evil than the other. I'm just trying to identify as best I can what happens. And there definitely seems to be a link between the concept of psychic phenomenon and the perpetuation of different types of media.
Are you taking into account the idea that psychic, of course, refers back to psyche? And Eros and Psyche, this myth, you have the idea of this woman who falls in love with this guy, but she's not able to really see him as he truly is. And at the moment where she sees him as he truly is, the illusion breaks down. You know, in the Greco-Roman version, it's like he's supposed to be so beautiful that she needs to know what he really looks like. But in doing so, you know, it was like basically her lack of faith broke their love. But Joseph Campbell compares it to the Native American version, going back to the Native Americans. We do have our Lost Boys dressing up as Indians, after all. You know, Joseph Campbell points out the Native American version of basically Eros and Psyche is that the woman gets visited by a man in the night and she ends up with him, but she's never allowed to actually see his true identity. And she has to stay inside the house, going back to The Shining, this sort of cabin fever. She has to stay inside the house while he goes out during the day. And she's not allowed to see what he really does. And so one day she actually sneaks out of her little teepee or something, and she sees all these crazy snakes, and that he's like king of the snakes. And she basically gets banished, that she was never supposed to see him in his true form, and basically is terrified to see his, you know, what he really is. She thought of him as this beautiful man. What is The Shining, of course, is her, is Wendy, you know, finding out how dark her husband really is. She's seeing the sort of true form of this man, and it's this terrifying thing that she has to escape out of. For Joseph Campbell, this actually was a good thing. The woman escapes, and she, you know, this was like she was being tricked by these dark sorcerers, and she had to escape from it and be self-empowered instead of being trapped by this, you know, lusty, dark spirit. So, of course, Wendy escapes. And I think the fact that he has put in there, you know, into The Shining, Kubrick has put the Red Book, he's put different psychological aspects. I can't imagine that wasn't part of it.
Yeah, but did he foresee the coming of a technology that would allow the common person the ability to investigate his films with the kind of depth that we are allowed to?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So that, yeah, that's huge.
Definitely. I mean, that's part of his whole, I mean, he wanted, for AI, he wanted technology to get to the point where he could have a robot actor, like, win an Oscar, you know, with a performance. Like a non-human act. Like, he wanted a real AI. And when he realized that wasn't going to happen in his lifetime, he was like, well, let's just get this hack Jew kid to do it.
Yeah, that's a pity. It's a film I would have liked to have seen if it had been directed by Kubrick. Not to say that I hate the Spielberg version, but...
Yeah.
But isn't there a sort of mirroring then of The Shining where, you know, Spielberg directs Kubrick's script? Or
I would... Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Kubrick, Spielberg being Danny in this case.
And, yeah, you know, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. The kid.
Yeah. Hey kid, I'll let you have a try at this stuff. See what you can mine out of it. But I wanted to go back a bit to what Alan was saying a second ago about the idea of Wendy escaping this particular paradigm of having seen this vision in the sense of psyche and psychic phenomenon. One of the things that I've the theories that I've put out there is that, and I actually think that I'm gonna just challenge what you're saying, Alan. Everything I think is correct up to the point that I think Wendy does know what kind of man the Jack is. She knows very well what kind he is. She knows perfectly well. And in fact, as I proposed, the movie The Shining is really a lot about Danny's revenge on Wendy for not doing anything about it. And this fits in with the concept of the Oedipal aspect of it. It's really Danny who is the one that Wendy is trying to escape. She might not know it, but that's the way it really is. And she fails to do so in the end. It's his psychic power that creates almost every event that happens in The Shining, in my viewpoint. And,
Mark, I agree with you in that Danny is angry at Wendy, because there's that scene where Danny / Tony is possessed, seemingly. His father is locked up in the kitchen, and maybe this is when Danny had gone down to let his father out of the kitchen, but he walks over to the dresser and he picks up a knife and he picks up lipstick. and he's walking over to Wendy, and it's almost as if he's saying, you know, you got us in a real fucked up situation here, and I can
only see
two fucking ways out of this. I either become a woman myself because he fucks you and he fucks me, or I take this knife and I kill you both. And he just doesn't know. He's in this binary choice. It's either kill you or fuck me, and he doesn't like either of them. And so when he writes Red Rum on the inverted cross of the door, it's almost as if, like, in the script, he's like saying, all right, I'm not going to have to choose either of these paths. The truth will go through this doorway, through this pathway. And he marks the spot where the story will continue through.
Sure, and it turns out to be a toilet, a bathroom.
Here's
what I think Danny is really getting at. This is what I believe that Danny has discovered, essentially. Is the underlying violence of sexuality itself and of the process of birth, right? There's a lot, you know, the elevators and the bloody room filling up is, to me, a symbol of, on one level, of menstruation, right? And Danny is... And it's funny because this almost makes Danny an AI, really, right? That's what Danny really is Kubrick's first attempt to show an artificial intelligence, because this kid is pissed off. He doesn't like the fact that he's born into this bloody massacre, and he recognizes it. He doesn't want to play a role in it, basically, and so he rebels against it on every single level. In regards to throwing all, the entire narrative, the blood of it, and the final vision of the blood room is Wendy's vision, right? That's, you know, the last time we see it, it's her seeing it, and it's her being covered up in the blood, and this blood comes right out of the idea of the food that we eat and the process of, you know, there's a line in the Scottish play, somebody needs to mute, there's a loud feedback right now, but there's a line from Macbeth. Where Banquo, and Banquo was the first victim of the whole affair, and Banquo says there's husbandry in heaven, and what this really means is that, you know, we're living on a farm, essentially, a kind of going right back to Genesis, we're living on a kind of an agriculture experiment, and we're not just tenders of the farm, we're also the victims of the farm, we're also the people who end up being consumed by the machine itself. And this is what Danny is reacting against in every way, I think, in the film. And I think that Kubrick sees this reaction. He is aware of this reaction. And he actually wants to, the whole film of The Shining, to me, is an attempt to repudiate Danny's reaction. It's the film ends up being a lesson for Danny. And this ends up being...
Absolutely, Mark, because it's America waking up to the history of their country, correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
It's true, but the thing of it is that, in a sense, that's what Danny is waking up to. Danny's waking up to the ugliness upon which America is built on, but I think that Kubrick is throwing that argument right back into Danny's face by saying that you're already a part of it and there's no way you can have there's no way you can get out of it.
Basically. You've already been touched. Yeah, you've been touched. That's right. You've been molested. It's in you. And sorry, kid, them's the breaks.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's why I think that The Shining's so important now, is that now Danny in real life is the same age as Jack was in the 70s. I mean, Danny's, he's going to be turning 40 this year.
Amazing. And amazing.
So, and I think that the you know, that cycle of abuse is so important. Like now is like, I mean, that's a real thing, like a real generational thing. You know, that what is Generation X? The Generation X being kind of like getting fucked over in the you know, course of history of just kind of like being scapegoated and just set off the pasture, while like, you know, the baby boom and the Generation Y kind of like reap the profits from it.
Well,
I can
see
wanting to like take a big wheel to Saturn as well.
Okay, Bill says, who wants to touch it? Halloran as Obama. Can I just tell you, there was in the 70s, an Alice in Wonderland porno, okay, where...
I used to have a copy of it.
Yeah, I found it online. It's not that bad, actually. You know, it just, as a head trip. pun, I guess, intended. It's... what's interesting to me is because I'm really fascinated by the idea of the King of Hearts, because the King of Hearts is the suicide king. It's a fixation I have. So in the Disney version, the Lewis Carroll version plays up the King of Hearts a little bit more. The Disney version completely downplays the King of Hearts. He's just a sort of joke character. But in this porno, they make the King of Hearts a very much of a character. And he is a black king. We know Osiris is a black god, a black king. So in this version, the King of Hearts has sex with Alice, and you see them like get out of bed when the Queen of Hearts shows up. You know, they get caught in bed together, and she's wearing his crown. And I just think that's this sort of fascination, and this sort of fascinating sort of passing the crown. As far as where you want to take that with Obama, I mean, aside from the obvious Osiris connection,
I think there's something interesting because we touched on the Kennedy assassination earlier.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the idea, and in a very real way, there's only one victim in the movie The Shining, and that's Halloran.
Correct.
He's the only one who dies.
Correct. He's the sacrificial lamb.
That's right, yeah. Everyone else goes to their own apparent continuation or maybe paradise, essentially, in the case of Jack.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's obviously an ambiguous question as to exactly where Jack goes, but he does appear to go somewhere, essentially. So his existence continues in that sense. And that all feeds into the whole idea that Kubrick was obsessed with, this idea of the afterlife, meaning that... being important, the whole concept of living on after one dies in some way or another.
If it's alchemical, the black man dies, so the black stage is
well,
gone.
The king has to die to atone for the sins of his people.
Right. So even Jack Torrance, after he dies, he ends up in the black and white photo. So he's brought it from black to white. You know, this sort of. Oh my God! And of course, alchemically, for the king to die, the king gets cooked, you know. And what does Jack say? The nigger cook. He's cooking the black king.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Holy
shit.
Well, back in the day, those halcyon days of the Rob Badger's Forum, John and I were twigging to the idea that there was a connection between Halloran and Chef from South Park. You know, both being a black cook,
exactly.
And it takes place,
exactly,
taking place in Colorado, essentially. But what I wanted to touch on before, when I was mentioning the Kennedy assassination, was that one of the things is that if you follow the Obama campaign for presidency, there are continual built-in references that Obama is Kennedy...
correct.
Resurrected.
Right.
For instance, his speech in Berlin. Right.
Wait, he's.
I mean,
he's. But they compare him to Kennedy, MLK, and Lincoln, which all three have the assassination connection. But now we have a new movie, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. Who are the vampires?
Right.
The Lost Boys. Sorry.
That's good.
Right. Well, yeah. So it's. Maybe. Are we seeing a resurrection with Obama, or are we seeing? Somebody who's being set up, essentially. This is so because the Kennedy connection. Go ahead.
I brought a whole chapter in the think book about it. Check it out.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at it right now, to tell you the truth.
But Jason and I have conflicting thoughts on specifically that note. I mean, So you, Jason points out Obama's campaign slogan was change, which of course equates him with the death card of the Tarot. So he, the King Kill was of course very much connected here. You know, when Barack Obama, this was my whole thing with the Suicide King, was Barack Obama, the weekend that he reintroduces his birth certificate, essentially a rebirth, is the week of Easter. So you have the reborn king. The image they're talking about is an image of Barack Obama as the death card on the Tarot.
Okay.
Beautiful illustration from Justin Morgan. Yes, everyone, please go buy a copy of the Sync book. But basically, so the week of Easter, Barack Obama introduces his birth certificate, so it's a rebirth of the king. Then he shows a video of, at the press conference, the press correspondence dinner on Saturday night, shows a video of him being born as the Lion King from Disney, bringing up the Disney connection again. He says, here's, I don't just have a birth certificate, I have video of my live birth. And here it is, it's, I'm the Lion King. So he's saying, I'm the Lion King. Then the next day, he announces that he killed Osama bin Laden. Osama means lion in Arabic and means king in Japanese. So essentially he's saying, I killed the Lion King, I've become the reborn Lion King. I've killed, so he's killing off a part of himself. Jason makes the point that this is, you know, the confrontation with the shadow. This is the idea of him, you know, overcoming his dark side. I just, from a practical standpoint, I that sounds nice, but I just don't see that. I see it as a confrontation.
It's a symbolic narrative. You think I'm taking it literally as he's literally the fucking Messiah. I'm just saying that this is a symbolic narrative that has no practical. It has no substance to it. It is simply a lot of symbols on the wall that you can take however you wish to take it. Now, in The Shining, it's important to note that Jack says that he's in charge of the Overlook until May 1st, which is the date that Bin Laden died.
Right, right, right. Which, of course, is Beltane, is the ritual killing of the king.
Right. And so the king has to die to atone for the dead girl, who is the May Queen, who was the original sacrifice in the creation of the universe. And so this gets me this whole thing, which is, of course, 237 again. And the Queen of Cups that he encounters when Jack enters that room.
Now, what? Okay, let me ask you, Jason, you've made the connection to, the Disney version of Peter Pan, the sort of Indian princess. So, of course, Peter Pan's affection is being vied for by Wendy and the Indian princess. There's this sort of competition there. So it's like,
yes,
if Jack Torrance is sort of making that choice, does he go for the ghosts of the Indians, or does he help Wendy out? Like, does there have to be this sort of thing? But of course, I just wonder if you would play up on that at all, the idea that there is this sort of being torn between Wendy and the spirit of the Indians.